and clear.
From the studios of Radio Sputnik in downtown Washington, D.C., it's Loud and Clear. We take you inside the news 5 days a week. It's happening, and it's happening now. I'm John Kiriakou, and I'm joined in studio by co-host Brian Becker. In this hour, we take a look at the breaking news of the day. First, Venezuelans are being forced to consider the possibility of civil war, as major European Union countries today recognized Juan Guaido as president and huge street mobilizations, both in favor of and opposed to the government of President Nicolas Maduro, took place. Next, Hawaii Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard formally announced her candidacy for president on Saturday. Her campaign is off to a rough start because of internal dissent, but her problem may be bigger than that. Is there room for an anti-war Democrat in the presidential race? Then, today we continue our segment Education for Liberation with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? And then French President Emmanuel Macron is expected to call for a national referendum to reduce the size of government in an effort to stem increasingly large yellow vest protests across the country. That would take place in May at the same time as elections for the European Parliament. At the same time, however, Macron has authorized police to fire rubber bullets at unarmed protesters, causing serious injuries and inflaming still more would-be protesters. Yellow vest leaders have called an assembly of assemblies, that is, yellow vest leaders from around the country, to discuss next steps. And finally, the truce in the U.S. trade war with China ends on March 2nd, when additional sanctions will go into effect absent a new trade agreement. President Trump says that a, quote, great deal, unquote, is in the works, but he may have to fight anti-China hawks in his own cabinet to come to such an agreement. That's all coming up next on Loud and Clear. Now we turn to Venezuela. Venezuelans are being forced to consider the possibility of civil war as major European Union countries today recognized Juan Guaido as president and huge street mobilizations both in favor of and opposed to the government of President Nicolas Maduro took place. We're joined from Mérida, Venezuela by Paul Dobson. He's a writer for VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Welcome back, Paul.
Good to be here.
Paul, on the international stage, it seems like the battle lines have been drawn. How hard is it going to be for President Maduro to withstand this external pressure from the likes of the European Union and the United States, especially when both the EU and the US are so willing to impose additional economic sanctions on an already weak economy?
I think the economic sanctions will be a lot more hurtful than the diplomatic position taken by these governments. It's worth remembering that these are measures which are being taken by, in many cases, governments which themselves are embattled and are currently very down in popular support in their own countries. We've seen very interesting statements come out in the last 24 hours from social movements and grassroots groups, especially in France, the Yellow Vests, for example, but also in Britain, in Germany, and in Spain. Rejecting the position taken by their government. No? But the economic measures which these countries may apply to Caracas is what's really going to hurt. Whether we see any sort of expansion of the oil embargo already issued by Washington and other restrictive measures.
Paul Dobson is our guest. We're talking to Paul from Venezuela. He's a writer for VenezuelaAnalysis.com. What was your take, Paul, on the mobilizations pro and against the government over the weekend?
Well, first, it should be pointed out that both mobilizations were held in an atmosphere of peace. There were no violent outbreaks reported, which I think is positive for all involved. The pro-government mobilization was extensive. It was extremely large, without a doubt. Obviously, very hard to judge numbers specifically, but somewhere around 200,000, between 100,000 and 300,000 probably is a ballpark figure. The opposition mobilization was equally large, of a similar size, we could say, potentially a little bit bigger. It was, however, notably smaller than the march held on January 23rd, when all of this started with a self-proclamation of Juan Guaido as president. No? The spirits were very high amongst the opposition supporters, even if they were slightly lower in numbers. However, we did definitely see a lack of concrete action taken by Juan Guaido when he spoke to his supporters. Many of his supporters were expecting the announcement of a new cabinet, a new government, or potentially the naming of a board for the Citgo oil subsidiary in the United States, or a series of other measures. None of this was forthcoming. And his speech essentially involved a series of promises for future action without any sort of details, leaving some of his supporters a little bit unhappy.
Tell me also, Paul, over the weekend, a senior general defected to the opposition. How important is that? Is that a blow to Maduro, or can he weather something like that?
This, I think, at the moment, it has to be considered as an isolated incident. This general was an office general, if you like. He was not in charge of it, or he is not in charge of any troops. He was, in fact, in charge of distributing rice in the government-controlled supermarket chain. So the influence of his position over the wider armed forces has to be in question. Whether this sets off some sort of domino effect, we'll have to see. And this is a worry which the government may have. But in itself, the defection of this general is not a significant act.
Paul Dobson is our guest. Paul is a writer for VenezuelaAnalysis.com. We've spoken to Paul and other members, writers, and editors from Venezuela Analysis over the past weeks. We're trying to have a better understanding than what one might possibly get or could get if you were following the mainstream corporate media. I can tell you, Paul, that the Washington Post on Sunday had a giant photo of what appeared to be a large demonstration in support of Guaido. There was no pictures of pro-Maduro, pro-government demonstrations, even though you say they were about the same size. And the other part of it that I think we don't see at all in the mainstream media here is what's going out on outside of Caracas. What are the relative strength between the pro-Maduro Bolivarian revolutionary forces outside of Caracas compared, say, to Guaido's forces?
Well, we've seen since events began on January 23rd, we've seen a series of mobilizations by pro-government forces across the country. They've now covered well over half of the states. Looking at the photos, they are extremely well attended. At VenezuelaAnalysis.com, we are trying to publish as many of these photos as we can so you can get a better understanding for yourself. No? Equally, on Saturday, opposition forces held regional rallies in most of the states across the country as well, which were well attended, without a doubt. No? So there is certainly a feeling of what's going on outside of Caracas. And we've seen some interesting developments, especially in the border region recently. So the state of Táchira and the state of Zulia, the Táchira state governor, who is an opposition member herself, a fairly extreme right-wing opposition politician, him on Saturday made statements suggesting that she had actually been threatened by right-wing forces for not having recognized the presidency of Juan Guaido, suggesting that there are some very deep internal divisions between the right-wing forces at the moment in Venezuela.
Paul Dobson, I'm looking at your website, VenezuelaAnalysis.com, and I can't overstate how important I think it is for people who want to know what's going on in Venezuela to go to your website, VenezuelaAnalysis.com, to get a different point of view. And it's also a point of view presented by English language writers and analysts who are in Venezuela. The headline of this article, it's on the very top of your front page, is Twitter erupts after 2,000 pro-Venezuelan accounts are deleted. A total of 1,196, yes, that's almost 2,000 social media accounts based in Venezuela have been closed, accused of, quote, influencing domestic audiences, close quote. I mean, what does that mean? And what about these accounts?
Well, I mean, this is just a blatant example of censorship. We see the United States government once again talking about freedom and democracy. And we see the United States firms, Twitter is an American-based firm for anyone who has forgotten, clamping down on the freedom of speech and those who maybe think different to the US government. This isn't the first time we've seen this. I'll remind your listeners that about 8 months ago, roughly, our own Facebook page was taken down for a short while in unexplained circumstances. We've also seen similar cases for regional news network Telesur and important spokespersons such as Abby Martin, who have also had problems on social media. So this just reinforces the fact that these companies are in no way independent. They are very much responding to the pressures and interests of the government, which control their financial activities in their home nation.
Yeah, it's really something. I want to encourage people to go and look at this article at VenezuelanAnalysis.com. And you quote, your journalist quote, Ben Norton, he accused the company Twitter of catering to, quote, U.S. government interests. Twitter is now removing thousands of accounts supposedly linked to Venezuela's sovereign government. This comes after Twitter suspended Venezuelan government accounts 15 years ago. Social media corporations act as an extension of U.S. government interests. They do.
Yeah, sure they do. And we've seen just over the last months even that anytime there is a movement that is not consistent with official U.S. government policy, whether domestic or foreign, social media organizations like Twitter and Facebook and Instagram and others just begin deleting accounts.
That's true. And Paul Dobson, you know, we saw John Bolton when he walked into the newsroom. He had written on his pad 5,000 troops to Colombia so that the media could read it. And of course, he didn't do that by mistake. But I saw a story about a Venezuelan military leader who came into a newsroom and he had written on his pad 2 million militia members. Anyway, what's the mood there? I mean, is there a sense that of resistance? Is there a sense that this is, if the U.S. and its allies are going to go for it, that there's a strength in the resistance to those who want to, you know, retain independence for Venezuela?
Well, I think beyond political divides and beyond opinions of Nicolas Maduro, his policies and Chavez and everything else, there is an overwhelming sense of national independence here in Venezuela, of patriotism, and of the sense that Venezuelans have to sort out their own affairs. This is something which has obviously grown in the last week or so with the threats instigated by Washington. And particularly those forces who support the government are currently, let's say, preparing themselves ideologically, physically, let's say, for any potential battles that may come, no? And here I'm not talking necessarily about physical battles. I'm talking about in the means of communication. I'm talking about discussions on the streets and so on. So there is definitely support for or rejection of U.S. intervention, let's say, which goes beyond the support for Nicolas Maduro. And I think this is an element which will be key in any sort of attempt by the United States to intervene militarily in Venezuela.
John, I know we're out of time, but I also want to let our listeners know that in about 5.5 weeks, there's going to be a very large demonstration here in Washington, D.C. on Saturday, March 16th at the White House. People coming from all over the country to say no to the coup, no to sanctions, and to do as Paul Dobson is suggesting Venezuelans want to do, which is to determine their own destiny free from U.S. interference.
Mm-hmm. I fear this is going to get worse before it gets any better. Well, we were very happy to be joined from Mérida, Venezuela by Paul Dobson. Paul's a writer for VenezuelaAnalysis.com. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Hawaii Congresswoman Tulsi Gabbard formally announced her candidacy for president on Saturday. Her campaign is off to a rough start because of internal dissent, but her problem may be bigger than that. Is there room for an anti-war Democrat in the presidential race? We're joined from Hawaii by Garland Nixon. He's the co-host of Sputnik News' Fault Lines, which you can hear every day between 7 and 10 a.m. Eastern Time. And he was on the ground covering the campaign announcement this weekend. Welcome to the show, Garland.
Thanks for having me on, guys.
Garland, tell us what the announcement was like. What kind of crowd was there? What was the reaction of the press?
Great. There was a huge crowd there. What was interesting, you know, I put a picture out that has since gone kind of viral, and that is the kind of press row elevated stand that they had in front of the stage for all of the cameras and the press to be able to get pictures of her. There was local press there. There was no CNN. There was no Fox. There was no MSNBC. I went to their websites. I searched. Her name was not there anywhere. There was radio silence. And the discussion, the mumblings, the murmuring amongst the crowd was about an NBC article that came out the morning of her announcement, which interestingly, it's interesting that, you know, how serendipitous that I should go. They had a picture of Lee Stranahan and I from our show and basically said, you know, she's Putin's favorite candidate, the usual Russian bot stuff. But I thought it was interesting. But so that was a big discussion in the crowd.
Garland Nixon is our guest. We're talking to him from Hawaii. He was there covering Tulsi Gabbard's announcement of her presidential run as a Democratic Party candidate, potential nominee. I want to go to that NBC story. John, it's really quite remarkable. It makes it clear that perhaps we've reached a tipping point in American politics.
I agree.
I mean, it's really something like if you come out, I mean, Tulsi Gabbard has been consistently anti-war. She was against the U.S. intervention in Syria, which was done through proxies. She's been against other U.S. military initiatives. But here's the NBC. It makes it appear now that Tulsi Gabbard is nothing but a stooge of the Kremlin and Putin. And the proof of it, according to this NBC News analysis, which relies on such great organizations like New Knowledge.
Right.
Which has been created.
Totally discredited.
I mean, they're creating their own false websites and Facebook pages. Facebook actually forced them to take them down. But actually, they're used in this news story to critique and explain why Tulsi Gabbard is Russia's favorite. Garland, I want to read a couple sentences to you from the NBC story again and get your comments. Russia's propaganda machine discovers 2020 Democratic candidate Tulsi Gabbard. Ooh, that sounds scary. Experts who track websites and social media linked to Russia have seen stirrings of a possible campaign of support for Hawaii Democrat Tulsi Gabbard. And then here it is. I mean, it's amazing, the proof. Since Gabbard's announced her intention to run on January 11th, there have been at least 20 Gabbard stories on three major Moscow-based English language websites affiliated with or supportive of the Russian government. RT.
That proves it.
Sputnik News, a radio outlet, our network, and Russian Insider, a blog that experts say closely follows the Kremlin line. The CIA has called RT and Sputnik part of, quote, Russia's state-run propaganda machine. So there's the proof, Garland. There's been 20 stories between three media networks affiliated with Russia that proves that Russia has initiated a campaign for Tulsi Gabbard. I mean, that's amazing.
And in that story, and that is very, very typical of the Russiagate stories, because they start off, can it get any weaker than this? Stirrings of a possible campaign. Can you get any weaker than that? Okay. In other words, there's nothing there, but let's go. Oh, let's pretend that there is. The interesting thing, I think one of the reasons is this. You know, one of the things that I like to do, I'll go to a story or an article and I'll search for words, right? When I search the Tulsi Gabbard script, you know, her speech, the word for the word war, it comes up like 30 times. That was the central theme. And she goes on and on about Mercer, you know, we must stand up against those who dishonor our troops, treating them as political pawns and mercenaries for hire in wars around the world. I mean, she goes on and on with an anti-war, you know, theme. So their claim seems to be, well, I guess if Putin doesn't want nuclear war, you should be in favor of it.
Exactly. That's
you know,
about it.
There was another thing, too, in this NBC article, and it's a theme that you see elsewhere in the mainstream media, and that is that she's some kind of a toady of Bashar al-Assad, that she went to Syria
on a fact-finding
mission to meet with Assad and didn't tell her Democratic colleagues in advance, as if somehow she needs to do that. And they also said that she questioned whether Assad used chemical weapons on his own people. Well, we now know that he did not use chemical weapons on his own people. But because she didn't toe the line, the official line, that Assad is a genocidal maniac who's been using chemical weapons on civilians, she's somehow in the pocket of both Assad and Putin.
And again, it reflects a changing position of the United States towards the Assad government. In the past, the United States worked with the Assad government on numerous issues.
Absolutely right.
Including during the Gulf War, Assad's father, Hafez al-Assad, was a partner with the United States.
Indeed. Sent troops as part of the coalition.
Yeah, and planes. Anyway, here's a couple sentences from that article, Garland. Quote, her promulgation of positions compatible with Russian geostrategic interests can help them mainstream such discussions in the Democratic Party, close quote. Said who? Alex Stamos, former chief security officer at Facebook and now an NBC News analyst. Mm-hmm. Gabbard, said Stamos, helps them with their all, quote, lines of attack. Now, again, it's what you said, John. You know, back in the day, back in the 1960s, if you signed a petition banning the bomb against nuclear weapons, and because some peace groups that were affiliated with the U.S. or World Peace Council, which was affiliated with the Soviet Peace Council, because they all signed the same agreement that they were against nuclear weapons, the McCarthyite right-wing red-baiters would say, if you were for peace and against nuclear war, that showed you were in the Soviet camp.
Mm-hmm.
People lost their jobs. I mean, people went to jail, literally. People became afraid to speak out. Garland, I think the same thing is happening, except now you have the so-called liberals performing the function of the McCarthyite right-wing red-baiters from 50 years ago.
Right. And look, right now, you can go right now, and if you search, you'll find an article with a picture of Nancy Pelosi sitting there talking to Bashar al-Assad from April 4th, 2007 that says, Pelosi meets with Syrian leader. You can go to 2012, September 27, 2012, the Moscow Times, and there's an article, Why Putin Wants Obama to Win. And it's a Russian newspaper. And in a Russian newspaper, they talk about why Putin would prefer Obama. So these types of things in international politics are fairly normal, but now they're being played and used to go after those who would go against the deep state, who would argue against the intel community. And I would argue this. This is a very, very trying time for us because we have people now in the deep state, in the integrity initiative, in these international networks of operatives who must usurp democracy. They cannot stand for someone like her or Jeremy Corbyn or someone who will actually listen to alternative arguments to get in power and say, well, perhaps Bill Browder is lying. Well, where is Yulia Skripal? Who asked? They can't handle that. So they have to stop democracy at all points if someone who is anti-war or at least a realistic leader.
John, I'm going back to this ridiculous NBC News story. It's ridiculous, but it's also, I think it's going to be very impactful because it sets the tone.
Oh, yeah. It was very inflammatory.
Now, part of what they're doing is they're saying that the Russians are also sinister and RT and Sputnik are also sinister about Tulsi Gabbard. And the proof of it is that Sputnik and RT are making fun of the media outlets that are claiming that Tulsi Gabbard is now a stooge. So that, too, becomes proof positive mm-hmm. that Tulsi Gabbard must be with the Russians if the Russians say this is nonsense.
Yes.
If you mock this campaign, that in itself becomes proof. Here's what it says. RT began defending Gabbard as soon as she announced. A behavioral science expert who studies social media tweeted out a vow on January 11th to start a GoFundMe campaign to finance a reporting trip to Gabbard's Hawaii district. Reporters for RT's television network pounced, calling it, quote, an investigative vacation, close quote, and a, quote, beachside investigation by, quote, establishment Democrats. Again, proof positive because RT mocked the campaign. And then RT headlined her decision to run for the president with this headline, Putin's puppet versus Assad shill. Dems and Republicans unite in panic over Gabbard challenging Trump in 2020. So again, RT is mocking this campaign. And that unless you surrender and don't speak, if you mock, if you mock the campaign, that shows that you're culpable.
Yeah, you're a stooge.
And it's one of these things. If you mock the campaign, that shows that you're culpable. If you don't mock the campaign, that shows that you're culpable. You know, the Russiagate has been, if it rains, that proves it. If it's sunny, that proves it. Whatever. It's a weird kind of religion kind of thing going on where you believe things as a matter of, you know, as an act of faith as opposed to evidence. But that was discussed there. And, you know, I think I talked to someone in the campaign who I know who, you know, through other, you know, I've known them online for a long time. Previous, they were a Bernie Sanders supporter, and now they've jumped over to her. And there was a discussion that in the campaign, there's a real concern. But based on what happened, it appears to me, and I don't have any inside information, of course, but it appears to me that she's going to lean into it. I think that's her only option, because if you back off, they're just going to, it's not like they're going to back off, but it appears she's going to lean into this. I mean, by saying this, they got to stop her before she gets to the debates. I think that's their move, because if she gets to the debates, or the Democratic debate, you'll have a bunch of Democrats saying one thing and one person who's going to stake out the anti-war corner, and that's a powerful corner, and they don't want to see what could happen if that goes down.
I think you're right. We were joined from Hawaii by Garland Nixon. Garland is the co-host of Sputnik News' Fault Lines, which you can hear every day between 7 and 10 a.m. Eastern Time. And he was on the ground in Hawaii covering the campaign announcement this weekend. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll take a short break and come right back.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
Today we continue our segment, Education for Liberation, with Bill Ayers, where Bill helps us look at the state of education across the country. What's happening in our schools, colleges, and universities, and what impact does it have on the world around us? Bill joins us from Maine. He's an activist, educator, and the co-author of the new book, You Can't Fire the Bad Ones, and 18 Other Myths About Teachers, Teachers' Unions, and Public Education. You can check out his work at www.billayers.org. Welcome back, Bill.
Good to hear your voices.
John, you know, we talk to Bill every week about the big issues in education. And of course, Bill Ayers is an expert on this. He's devoted his entire life to it. Bill Ayers has also devoted his entire life to the struggle for peace and against U.S. imperial domination, snuffing out or attempting to snuff out the rights of other people to exercise self-determination. And so why don't we get started, Bill, because I know you're paying careful attention to what's going on in Venezuela. We've talked about it a lot on this show, but I want to get your take.
Well, you know, my take comes from spending a fair amount of time in Venezuela during the Chavez years. I went down there initially at the invitation of the Department of Education down there and gave several talks, and most importantly, went to several communities where education was on the agenda. I mean, one of the things that people in this country conveniently forget, and the media, New York Times, National Public Radio, really sound like outlets for the U.S. State Department, but the kind of imperial mentality that's so transparent wipes out the fact that Chavez, when he came in 1998, Chavez actually spent all of his energy eradicating poverty and illiteracy. I took buses up into the mountains where there were circles of people, grandmothers, pregnant women, field workers, at 8 o'clock at night in literacy circles. It was the most inspiring educational project I've ever seen, and massive. And so food insecurity, illiteracy, poverty were really being taken on as the major issues that the Chavez government took on. So I met a lot of the educators, a lot of the teachers. They were following an approach to education pioneered, as you both unlikely know, by Paulo Freire, and the idea of the pedagogy of the oppressed. That is, creating circles of literacy everywhere, in the urban slums, in the impoverished communities in the countryside, where people named their own problems and learned to write and read by writing their own primers, dealing with the social issues that they were confronting. So for me, what I can't kind of bear when I look at the current situation is both the kind of manufactured amnesia of the American media and the American kind of stance towards this thing. And then on top of that, the erasing of the great steps forward that socialism made in Venezuela. I don't know if you saw the Bret Stephens piece in the New York Times. The title was something like, Venezuela is another example of socialist catastrophe. And it is such a hit piece by a conservative New York Times columnist. But what's conveniently left out is the deep history of colonialism, the ways in which the global South was trapped by structures, you know, of colonialism. For example, Cuba got all of its resources from sugar, a single crop. Venezuela was oil. So the collapse of the oil market meant internationally that Venezuela suddenly was impoverished. And you add to that sanctions, you add to that boycotts and blockades, and you have a recipe for catastrophe. And that's what we're seeing in Venezuela. There's a lot to criticize about the Bolivarian Revolution, but the fact is it's not a case at all of socialism's failure. It's a case of colonial intervention, colonial history coming back to haunt us again and again.
Yeah, that's important. I mean, if you make a critique of every country that has a capitalist economic system, and in some ways Venezuela still does, even though the government has a socialist perspective. But if you went through and documented all the starvation, the people who are illiterate, the people who have no access to basic services, and if in each and every case you looked at those problems and said, there is the crisis of capitalism, another capitalist failure, you know, then people would learn that capitalism is a failed system. But that's not how it's presented. In America, because the focus of media attention is hardly ever on the poor and always on the celebrities and the well-to-do and the affluent and the corporate owners, it's never talked about as a failure of capitalism that in this, the richest country in the world, one out of every five children lives below the poverty line. One out of every five, or that 10% of all the kids in New York City schools are homeless. That's not called a failure of capitalism. There may be a problem, but it's not the failure of capitalism. But in an emerging, developing country that has any crisis like Venezuela clearly does, accentuated by economic sanctions, as you presenting it, that's called the failure of socialism. And it's this dominant narrative, and it's just run over and over and over again, the idea of which is to conclude that socialism can never work. It's never going to work. Go ahead.
Well, I mean, exactly. And the idea is to kind of put this stain on socialism as if it's the socialist system itself that's causing the pain in Venezuela. The reality is, I know you had a colleague from reporting from Venezuela on your show just now, but I would add, I think Vijay Prashad, I don't know if you know, you must know Vijay.
Yeah, he's a frequent guest on our show.
Well, Vijay just wrote the most marvelous analysis of the history of situations like Venezuela. And I'll just tell you the kind of, he has something he calls the 12 steps that lead up to invasion in this colonial. And step one is what I just mentioned, and that is the history of colonialism, which creates structures that are very difficult to get out of. Step two is any attempt by the formerly colonized nations to unite in order to have a fair shot at international trade, like OPEC, which most of us remember, the Organization of Petroleum Exporting Countries. That was an attempt to create a kind of a colleagueship in which they could like face the West and face the big capitalisms with some sense of equity. Step three is to destroy agriculture in the South. Step four, plunder. Step five, debt as a way of life. It's staggering to realize that debt payments have ballooned to 60%. So a country like Angola pays 55% of its export revenues to service its debt. And then finances go to hell.
And Angola's another oil exporter.
Exactly, exactly. And then public finances go to hell, deep cuts in social spending. And then, this is important for Americans, social distress leads to migration. There are 68.5 million people on the move because of the colonial history right now, today. And then you control the narrative by manipulating the media. You question who the real president is. And then you say, well, it's caught, you know, the sanctions have cost so much, and the situation is in collapse, so we must go to war. I mean, one of the astonishing things is the Trump administration, which is doing very much what the Obama administration did and what other administrations did before that, except that it's doing it in the open. From the time Chavez was elected in 1998 to the present, there have been something like 8 or 12 coup attempts. The United States has paid for the opposition. The United States has manipulated the situation. But here comes the Trump administration quite openly. The vice president calls the opposition and says, we will honor your claim to the presidency if you take it. So then Trump appoints Elliot Abrams, who lied to Congress about the Iran-Contra deal and was pardoned by George H.W. Bush. In 2002, he was linked to the coup attempt in Venezuela. He supported the Montt administration in Guatemala, which was charged with genocide. So here we are openly leading. The U.S. is openly leading a coup, and new sanctions have been imposed, and the world is crumbling for Venezuela. And the pain is real, and the mistakes are real, but the culprit really is the United States and Canada and the other Western imperialisms.
Bill, we diverted from our normal topic of education in the United States, but I'm glad we did because your insights are important. And also, the fact that the Venezuelan Revolution put a priority on education, on literacy in particular, as well as alleviating the very grave poverty that existed in the country, I think it's completely appropriate. Of course, when Chavez came to power, 1% of the population owned 70% of the land. And that was Venezuelan democracy. Now it's changed a lot since then. We have about 90 seconds left. I do want to mention, though, what's going on in Denver, because, of course, we have the L.A. teacher strike. Let's just end on the new wave of teachers' actions.
Well, I think we've covered this, and I think it's hugely important. I do think there's a link between what's going on in Venezuela and your conversation a minute ago about socialism. You know, socialists tend to prioritize education, healthcare, guarantees of income, care for the elderly, care for the young. And that's not true under a brutal capitalist system. And so that's an important pivot. But yes, in Denver, in Virginia, all over the country, in Chicago again, in Oakland, what's important to note is that the teachers rising are rising in partnership with parents and community, and they're rising to defend one of the great hopeful institutions, and that is the possibility of public education for all as a human right, as a community responsibility. And we're seeing that played out in Denver and Oakland right now. Virginia is on the agenda. This is not going to stop. It's rolling forward, and it's a turning point. We have to get behind it. We have to support it.
That was the voice of Bill Ayers, who joins us every week. This week, Bill's in Maine. He's an activist, educator, and the co-author of the book You Can't Fire the Bad Ones and 18 Other Myths About Teachers, Teachers Unions, and Public Education. Check out his work at www.billayers.org. He'll be back with us next week. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
French President Emmanuel Macron is expected to call for a national referendum to reduce the size of government in an effort to stem increasingly large yellow vest protests across the country. That would take place in May, at the same time as elections for the European Parliament. At the same time, however, Macron has authorized police to fire rubber bullets at unarmed protesters, causing serious injuries and inflaming still more would-be protesters. Yellow vest leaders have called an assembly of assemblies, that is, yellow vest leaders from around the country, to discuss next steps. We're joined by Gilbert Mercier. He is the editor-in-chief of News Junkie Post and the author of The Orwellian Empire. Welcome back, Gilbert.
Thank you for having me, you guys.
Gilbert, there were more and larger protests over the weekend, and there doesn't seem to be any end in sight to these nationwide protests. Do you think this referendum will have any effect? Will it placate the protesters?
I really don't think so. The referendum is considered to be sort of a gimmick because Macron wants to time it possibly on the same day that the European election, and it's kind of a trick to get voters to go to the polls. And also the big issue on the quote unquote referendum are not on the table, which is the RIC, the referendum of citizen initiative, and the impôt sur la fortune. So it's kind of a trick, just like the so-called Grand Débat National. Now, you mentioned in your introduction that the Act of 12 that took place like Saturday was very well attended indeed. According to the Gilets Jaunes, it was more than 115,000 people. However, according to the Ministère de l'Intérieur, the Interior Minister, it was only about 69,000, but they've been fudging the number. However, most press observers would give the attendance to higher than 100,000. And the protests were actually dedicated to the numerous victim of the flashbulb that you mentioned, the infamous LBD-30, which is an extremely controversial gun equipping French riot police, and it fires very large rubber bullets, which are roughly exactly 40 millimeters by 46 millimeters, which is bigger than a tennis ball. Now, there's supposed to be a restriction on the use of this weapon, which happened to be manufactured probably, I suppose, in Switzerland, which is not to be aimed to, not to be fired at a short distance and not to be aimed at any vital area, such as the head or the genitals. However, they've been doing that extensively, and as of today, there's about more than 110 people which have lost an eye or had like broken jaw or lost a limb and so on. So it's a very serious situation. However, the use of the gun, which some lawyers were trying to ban, have been deemed legal by the Assemblée Constitutionnelle. So here you go. So the French CRS and riot police will still be able to use that weapon that is not considered to be lethal, but can seriously injure many, and has since November 17. So as far as where there's also something else that the Macron administration, who is has an expertise in sending mixed signals, they are cooking on a legislation which is called Loi Anti-Casseur. And this legislation would basically allow the government, not a judge, but a préfet, which is sort of like I would in the U.S. justice system, probably I would say a DA or something like that, not a judge, to ban anybody that they deem not suitable for any protest. It would be, a way to curtail the fundamental right to protest in France. Okay, and there's something very interesting. There's a group of lawyers, there's about 60 French lawyers to be precise, that have joined forces to raise the alarm on this justice system treatment of the Gilets Jaunes. And the lawyers are denouncing what they call an assault on right and public liberty. The justice system in France, and this is very alarming, and people should be talking more about that, is really in the process of being taken over by the executive branch of government. I mean, in most democracy, the justice system is supposed to be independent of the executive. And in France, it's becoming extremely blurred. And of course, the same group of lawyers are denouncing this loi anti-casseur as something that is, and are going to try to challenge it. The law is not voted as of yet. It's going to be voted this week, but it's probably going to pass. And the lawyers want to challenge this as anti-constitutional.
That's the voice of Gilbert Mercier. We're talking to him about the protests, the Yellow Vest protests in France. Gilbert, I want to thank you for letting us know more about this so-called less than lethal weapon, the size of, some say, a golf ball, some say a tennis ball. Nonetheless, many protesters have been killed, mutilated, blinded. Here at the same time, you have the Macron government denouncing the Maduro government for mistreating protesters, showing that the double standard and hypocrisy is in more or less boundless. But I want to go back where we started about this assembly of assemblies. Can the Yellow Vest movement, which is politically nebulous, which is, you know, it's basically a grassroots movement that is united based on suffering, based on despair, based on outrage, is it able to, or will it be able to, come together as with a coherent political program?
Well, that is still up to be seen. I mean, there's some interesting development here, which is the fact that Marine Le Pen, which is, the French far right, is in agreement, apparently, with the loi anti-casseur, this repressive legislation. And she's not scoring a lot of points with the Gilets jaunes in that regard. So the one that, unless the Gilets jaunes decide to put together their own list, and some have, but the one that have are actually very close to the Macron France En Marche, so they're kind of defector Gilets Jaunes, if you wish, and they consider by most Gilets Jaunes the one of Eric Drouet, Fly Rider, and Priscilla Ludovsky to be sort of traitors in a way. So will they constitute a list of their own? Or will their vote go to reinforce, which is likely, La France Insoumise, which has really done a lot to recuperation of the movement, but basically the political platform of Jean-Luc Mélenchon, the leader of France Insoumise, is very, very similar to the revendications of the Gilets jaunes in terms of being, if you wish, an anti-neoliberalist, an anti-capitalist movement, like what I call a real left, as opposed to, a lot of the previous left in France, like Hollande, which is obviously is not a left anymore, which is just a vague, neoliberalist policy. But you pointed out about the curiosity about Macron, where he stands, and in all this vis-à-vis Venezuela, it is truly absurd and ironic in its obvious contradiction. The fact that Macron, who is still called to resign by a lot of people in France, and of course the Gilets jaunes, is so enthusiastic about the U.S.-sponsored coup attempt in Venezuela under the disguise of a fake revolution. And it is especially disconcerting, and that's something that your listener will truly enjoy, and that nobody is talking about even in France, and I would say especially in France, that a few years ago, a man by the name of Ismaël Emilien, an important Macron advisor, very close to him, who actually started La République En Marche with Macron, and Emilien worked in the first Maduro campaign to get Maduro elected. So that's very ironic.
Yeah, the irony is nonstop. We're going to keep following this story. That was Gilbert Mercier, an important voice about what's going on with the Yellow Vest movement.
He is indeed. Gilbert is the editor-in-chief of News Junkie Post, and he's the author of The Orwellian Empire. Stay tuned to Loud and Clear. We'll be back after we take a short break.
Loud and Clear.
You're listening to Weekday World on CPR.
Loud and Clear.
Welcome back to Loud and Clear. I'm John Kiriakou.
And I'm Brian Becker.
The truce in the U.S. trade war with China ends on March 2nd when additional sanctions will go into effect absent a new trade agreement. President Trump says that a, quote, great deal, unquote, is in the works, but he may have to fight anti-China hawks in his own cabinet to come to such an agreement. We're joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek. He's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. Welcome, Walter.
Happy to be here.
Walter, the president's saying one thing. People who are actually involved in the talks with China are saying another thing. And we have no idea what role the Huawei scandal is going to play in these talks. What are you hearing?
Well, I think the latest round of negotiations, which is a very high-level round of negotiations, went well. The vice premier was leading the delegation, Liu He, who is considered to be Chinese President Xi Jinping's top economic lieutenant, one of the highest-ranking people in the Chinese government. Donald Trump has certainly been optimistic in public, but I think you're certainly right that there are people within the administration and perhaps even the majority of people in the administration who want some type of confrontation with China to continue. Certainly that's the majority of people in the administration. But I think there's sort of two like sub camps within that grouping. There's the people who have sort of an ideological predisposition to opposing China, who kind of have made that their thing throughout their career. Peter Navarro, the U.S. trade representative, is certainly one of those people, and I think you could put Wilbur Ross in that same category. They're the death by China people. And then there's the sort of more mainstream establishment elite people who, you know, believe in the U.S. national security strategy that the U.S. is entering, the world is entering a period of great power competition. China needs to be contained, encircled. That was certainly the policy of the Obama administration as well. And so even if, you know, the tactic of tariffs is controversial, they certainly don't want there to be an improvement in overall relations with China. So yeah, I think it's very, very much an open question whether or not these actually succeed despite this progress that we've seen over the past few days.
So we've got this odd situation. There was a meeting here in Washington between the deputy premier and the U.S. trade representative. There was a meeting with the president. The U.S. trade representative is Robert Lighthizer. He's a well-known China hawk. He doesn't like China. The Chinese don't like him. And as it turned out, there really wasn't any progress made in the last round of talks, especially on the issue of intellectual property protection. The Chinese are sort of infamous for stealing American intellectual property, copying it, and then selling it more cheaply. So no progress was made there. The president ignored that and said the talks were great, everything was great. And in the meantime, the Chinese are actually continuing with their opening to financial services organizations. So the co-president of JP Morgan just a few days ago, this is Daniel Pinto, said that no matter how the talks turn out, JP Morgan is still on track to open a new investment bank in China this year and to acquire a greater stake in Chinese wealth management firm that it's already partnered with. So let's say that there isn't an agreement come March 1st and new sanctions go into effect March 2nd. What does that do to American businesses that have already thrown their lot in with China?
Well, it certainly hurts a big sector of U.S. capital, you know, manufacturing in particular, high-tech companies that manufacture a lot of their products in China. There are other sectors that love the tariffs, right? So heavy industry is left in the United States is definitely all about the U.S.-China trade war. And you're definitely right that this is causing significant economic problems in China. I mean, it's not like China's on the verge of collapse or anything, but the leadership, I think, is clearly worried about the effects of this, which is something that makes a deal more likely. China has been experimenting with a number of different economic policy reforms to stimulate the economy. The biggest ones have been tax cuts, right? So they've been very resistant to do massive stimulus spending on infrastructure, which is how they reacted to the 2008-2009 economic crisis. They're doing other things like cutting the reserve requirement ratio for their banks, meaning that banks have to hold less of their money in reserves and can therefore lend more. But I think that like large-scale privatizations, like really significant changes in terms of technology transfers, the things that are sort of core to the Chinese development model, I don't think they're willing to bargain over that.
You know, John and Walter, the per capita income in China on average is about one quarter of what it is in the United States, 25%. So China in aggregate is developing a lot. But China is emerging from a very long legacy of poverty, underdevelopment, sort of a neocolonialism, a semi-colonialism. And so it's going to take them a long time. That means the average worker in China has one quarter of what the average worker in the United States has, right, in terms of income. Here's Peter Navarro last month. White House advisor Peter Navarro says, quote, China is trying to steal our future. White House trade advisor Peter Navarro tells the Japanese newspaper Nikkei that an agreement in 90 days will be difficult, and Beijing needs to be, quote, prepared for a full overhaul of its trade and industrial practices. He said China is basically trying to steal the future of Japan, the U.S., and Europe by going after our technology. This is so ridiculous. It's such nonsense. Peter Navarro, by the way, is a China expert, right? He's a China hawk.
Yeah.
And he's a China expert. He doesn't speak Chinese. He ran for office 5 times and lost. He's an economics professor in San Diego. He decided to reinvent himself and write a book, Death by China. And now he's saying to a country that has a per capita income 25% that of what exists in the United States, that they are stealing our future. I mean, just pure one, stupidity.
And people listen to that.
Not if they listen to our show. That's They're going right. to stop listening to this nonsense. It's also just straight out racism.
Yeah, of course. I mean, the way think about how the United States developed as a country, right? I mean, there was theft, but it was theft of people. It was kidnapping of millions of enslaved Africans, millions of whom died. It was theft of the land of the United States, right? The genocide against indigenous people. The same thing goes for all the Western European countries that became so developed by building massive colonial empires.
Are you trying to say the U.S. stole their future?
I think that's true. I think that's an accurate assessment of how the U.S. and every other major world power developed, every other major Western world power developed. And so China is trying to overcome, if you really want to take the big historical picture like we're doing, from the century of humiliation that began with the Opium Wars in the 1840s, where, British imperialism said, you will buy our opium. You're not allowed to ban it. You have to, keep importing this because we make a ton of money on it. And that led to that semi-colonization that you talked about. And now China has to, what they're doing right now is that they want to overcome or avoid the quote middle income trap, which is something that happens frequently in developing countries, meaning basically you get to a certain point with large scale manufacturing, but then you're unable to make the leap to become a wealthy country that is more focused on service sector things and high tech.
John and Walter, when we're looking at the media headlines today, there's skepticism, even though Trump says it's going to be a great deal. Somebody should do a survey of how many times Donald Trump has used the word great. That said, skepticism.
Donald Trump is the only person saying there's going to be a deal. He's the only person saying that these talks are going well. They're not going well. There's been an agreement on nothing. And there are several different major gulfs between the U.S. side and the Chinese.
The fact that there was a criminal indictment of Huawei, in addition to the still incarceration or semi-incarceration of their chief financial officer the day before the talks begin, and then the Trump administration somehow says, oh, but those two things are not connected. Really? Grabbing, kidnapping, taking hostage the leader of China's major technology company?
Yeah, and of course, it's related to that overall campaign that we're just talking about to prevent China from developing, from getting to that next stage of development. So I understand the skepticism. I think there is a way for a deal to happen, not on all these fundamental things that we're talking about. And certainly, I don't think anybody really expects the U.S. and China to become sort of friends in the long term, right? They're clearly on this path of confrontation because of the orientation of the United States. But I think there can be a deal in the sense that China may agree to make very large purchases of particular U.S. commodities.
Yeah, they're going to buy a lot of soybeans.
Soybeans, yeah, right. And maybe other things that basically give Donald Trump what he truly wants, which is just sort of like a domestic political boost for, very particular narrow electoral reasons. So I think something like that is actually totally possible.
Well, we were happy to be joined here in the studio by Walter Smolarek, who's a Sputnik News analyst and one of the producers of this show. You're listening to Loud and Clear. We are out of time. Be sure to go to our Facebook page, Loud and Clear with Brian Becker, for daily updates. If you enjoy the show and want your friends to hear it, let us know by liking the page on Facebook. And you can follow us on Twitter at Loud Clear Radio. You can also hear us every day, Monday through Friday, from 4 to 6 p.m. on 105.5 FM and 1390 AM in the Washington, D.C. area. You can hear us at SputnikNews.com and as a podcast at iTunes, iHeartRadio, Spreaker, and Spotify. Remember, telling the truth is important, but to make a difference, it has to be loud and clear. We'll see you next time.
Loud and Clear. Thank you.